Chapter 13. Everything human is pathetic. The secret source of humor itself is not joy but sorrow. There is no humor in heaven. Pudd'nhead Wilson's New Calendar. Captain Cook found Australia in 1770, and 18 years later the British government began to transport convicts to it. Altogether, New South Wales received 83,000 in 53 years. The convicts wore heavy chains, they were ill-fed, and badly treated by the officers set over them. They were heavily punished for even slight infractions of the rules. The cruelest discipline ever known is one historian's description of their life. The Story of Australasia. J. S. Laurie. English law was hard-hearted in those days. For trifling offenses which in our day would be punished by a small fine or a few days' confinement, men, women, and boys were sent to this other end of the earth to serve terms of 7 and 14 years, and for serious crimes they were transported for life. Children were sent to the penal colonies for 7 years for stealing a rabbit. When I was in London 23 years ago, there was a new penalty in force for diminishing garroting and wife-beating, 25 lashes on the bare back with the cat-o-9 tails. It was said that this terrible punishment was able to bring the stubbornest ruffians to terms, and that no man had been found with grit enough to keep his emotions to himself beyond the 9th blow. As a rule, the man shrieked earlier. That penalty had a great and wholesome effect upon the garroters and wife-beaters. But humane modern London could not endure it. It got its law rescinded. Many a bruised and battered English wife has since had occasion to deplore that cruel achievement of sentimental humanity. 25 lashes. In Australia and Tasmania they gave a convict 50 for almost any little offense. And sometimes a brutal officer would add 50, and then another 50, and so on, as long as the sufferer could endure the torture and live. In Tasmania I read the entry, in an old manuscript official record, of a case where a convict was given 300 lashes for stealing some silver spoons. And men got more than that, sometimes. Who handled the cat? Often it was another convict. Sometimes it was the culprit's dearest comrade, and he had to lay on with all his might, otherwise he would get a flogging himself for his mercy, for he was under watch and yet not do his friend any good. The friend would be attended to by another hand and suffer no lack in the matter of full punishment. The convict life in Tasmania was so unendurable, and suicide so difficult to accomplish, that once or twice despairing men got together and drew straws to determine which of them should kill another of the group. This murder to secure death to the perpetrator, and to the witnesses of it by the hand of the hangman. The incidents quoted above are mere hints, mere suggestions of what convict life was like. They are but a couple of details tossed into view out of a shoreless sea of such. Or, to change the figure, they are but a pair of flaming steeples photographed from a point which hides from sight the burning city which stretches away from their bases on every hand. Some of the convicts, indeed, a good many of them, were very bad people, even for that day. But the most of them were probably not noticeably worse than the average of the people they left behind them at home. We must believe this. We cannot avoid it. We are obliged to believe that a nation that could look on, unmoved, and see starving or freezing women hanged for stealing 26 cents worth of bacon or rags, and boys snatched from their mothers, and men from their families, and sent to the other side of the world for long terms of years for similar trifling offenses, was a nation to whom the term civilized could not in any large way be applied. And we must also believe that a nation that knew, during more than 40 years, what was happening to those exiles, and was still content with it, was not advancing in any showy way toward a higher grade of civilization. If we look into the characters and conduct of the officers and gentlemen who had charge of the convicts, and attended to their backs and stomachs, we must grant again that, as between the convict and his masters, and between both and the nation at home, there was a quite noticeable monotony of sameness. 4 years had gone by, and many convicts had come. Respectable settlers were beginning to arrive. These two classes of colonists had to be protected, in case of trouble among themselves, or with the natives. It is proper to mention the natives, though they could hardly count, they were so scarce. At a time when they had not as yet begun to be much disturbed, not as yet being in the way, it was estimated that in New South Wales there was but one native to 45,000 acres of territory. People had to be protected. Officers of the regular army did not want this service away off there, where neither honor nor distinction was to be gained. So England recruited and officered a kind of militia force of 1,000 uniformed civilians called the New South Wales Corps and shipped it. This was the worst blow of all. The colony fairly staggered under it. The corps was an object lesson of the moral condition of England outside of the jails. The colonists trembled. It was feared that next there would be an importation of the nobility. In those early days the colony was non-supporting. All the necessaries of life, food, clothing, and all were sent out from England, and kept in great government storehouses, and given to the convicts and sold to the settlers, sold at a trifling advance upon cost. The corps saw its opportunity. Its officers went into commerce, and in a most lawless way. They went to importing rum, and also to manufacturing it in private stills, in defiance of the government's commands and protests. They leagued themselves together, and ruled the market. They boycotted the government and the other dealers. They established a close monopoly, and kept it strictly in their own hands. When a vessel arrived with spirits, they allowed nobody to buy but themselves, and they forced the owner to sell to them at a price named by themselves, and it was always low enough. They bought rum at an average of $2 a gallon, and sold it at an average of 10. They made rum the currency of the country, for there was little or no money, and they maintained their devastating hold, and kept the colony under their heel for 18 or 20 years, before they were finally conquered and routed by the government. Meantime, they had spread intemperance everywhere. And they had squeezed farm after farm out of the settlers' hands for rum, and thus had bountifully enriched themselves. When a farmer was caught in the last agonies of thirst, they took advantage of him, and sweated him for a drink. In one instance they sold a man a gallon of rum worth $2 for a piece of property which was sold some years later for $100. When the colony was about 18 or 20 years old, it was discovered that the land was specially fitted for the wool culture. Prosperity followed. Commerce with the world began. By and by rich mines of the noble metals were opened. Immigrants flowed in. Capital likewise. The result is the great and wealthy and enlightened Commonwealth of New South Wales. It is a country that is rich in mines, wool ranches, trams, railways, steamship lines, schools, newspapers, botanical gardens, art galleries, libraries, museums, hospitals, learned societies. It is the hospitable home of every species of culture, and of every species of material enterprise, and there is a church at every man's door, and a racetrack over the way. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.